I have never run this fast, never known the depth of my lungs, and I make it onto the street and disappear into the subway, and now I might throw up, and I heave and I smile. Those Germans were right after all. There really is such a thing as a runner's high. And it's a good thing that I'm a bit high on life, because a little while later, I get a rather upsetting text from you. Can't get together tonight. I'm at New York Presbyterian. Peach. Frowny face. She is supposed to be in a morgue, not a hospital. Because I have no idea what happened, because I'm not a stalker, I respond surprised and inquire about details. You tell me that she got attacked in the park, but there's good news too, according to you. She's lucky. A girl found her right after it happened, otherwise she might be, you know. I write back. But she's gonna be okay? You write back. Well, physically, yes, but emotionally, this is hard. She'll be in the hospital for a while. You'd never be talking to me if Peach got a glimpse of me, so at least I can be grateful for that. I offer to help, and you insist that you don't need me, but I will show you that I am a good boyfriend, and I will look beyond the injustice of her getting a bed in a hospital. She only gets to stay because her dad is on the board of the hospital. And it's not fair to think of all the genuinely sick people turned away. But nothing is fair. Chapter 21. I'm not mad. Really, I'm not mad. You're a good friend. I know that Peach's parents have already gone back to San Francisco, and I know that you have to be there for her. I am not going to challenge you like Lynn and Hannah, who throw around words like codependent. I refuse to visit Peach in the hospital. I'm not mad. I'm not. I prove that I'm not mad by sending flowers to her in the hospital. I even pay extra for a big yellow balloon with a smiley face. Does a guy who's mad buy the balloon? No, he doesn't. And I'm not being a dick to customers either. You can tell I'm not mad because I'm more patient than ever. I don't lay into Curtis about being late, and I don't bitch him out when he forgets to order more Dr. Sleep, the only book we're moving, aside from the prequel, of course, and watching that book settle in at the top of the Times bestseller list makes me more and more aware of the fact that we're not progressing. Our first real date was the day that book came out, and now that book's breaking records and having its third fucking month on the bestseller list. And I'm reading about the inevitable movie adaptation on the internet for no reason at all, and I am not mad at you, or at King, or at the customers, or Peach, or anything. I am not mad she's a liar. I feel for the poor girl. She's obviously a product of her family's sociopathic tendencies, and she's tragically obsessed with you, and honestly, if anything, I'm just worried for you. And I can wait. Some good shit happens fast, a best-selling book, and some good shit happens slow. Love, I get it. You are busy. You got class, I get it, and you got Peach, I get it, and you're not avoiding me, I get it, and you have pages due, I get it, and Peach just can't deal with being around guys, I get it, and you can't email as much with all that's going on, I get it, and you think of me when you get into your bed that I made for you, I get it. You see, Beck, I am not a narcissistic asshole who expects his needs to come first at all times. I wake up and run to the water and back, and my legs are firmer all the time. You'll see eventually. And I sell King, and I read King, and I eat lunch alone, and dinner alone. And not once do I bitch at you about blowing me off. Not once. The balloon, Beck, it was almost $10 more with the tax, and when I asked you if it got there, I could hear the Peach in you. Yeah, you said. It did. Is something wrong? Well, Joe, forget it. I mean, for her, everything is wrong right now, you know? Beck, what the fuck? And I didn't say that in an asshole way. I just wanted you to be straight with me. Joe, never mind. It's fine. Obviously, it's not. You let out a sigh, and you're the one who's mad, and you sound different. Like you've been drinking the green juice delivered to Peaches each morning. Like you're starting to like this way of life. Sleeping uptown. Waking up without a single piece of IKEA in the room. Don't get mad. I'm not mad, Beck. We both just felt like the balloon was a little insensitive. Insensitive? I mean, it's a smiley face. It's a get-well balloon. Yes, but Joe, it's not that simple. On the website, it's right there in the get-well section. Yes, but it's not like she got hurt playing tennis. Tennis. Beck, be reasonable. I am reasonable. I meant no harm. I know, Joe. It's just that a giant yellow smiley face is kind of the last thing in the world you want to see when there's some creep out there who broke into your home and attacked you. I mean, it's a smile. This is just like... Jesus, I said. It's not a smiling kind of time. I'm sorry. You don't have to be sorry. Beck, can we get coffee or something? I really can't right now. You never sounded farther away from me. And I will take that balloon and stab the fuck out of it, and at the same time, I will take that balloon and tie it around Peach's neck, because who the fuck can cunt out over a balloon? Well, it's been 7 hours and 6 whole days since Peach got home from the hospital. You are busy with school and busy with Peach, still living at her house. But you are not too busy to exchange emails with a stranger named CaptainNedAck@gmail.com. You. Hey, can you call me? Captain. Not right now. Are you still coming this weekend? You. I'm really busy. Can't you just call me? Captain. I want to see you. You. I don't have a car. Captain. Get one and I'll take care of it. You're still size small, right? You. Yes. When your plans with the captain are finalized, you leave Peach's place and get into a cab. I call you. I get voicemail, and I do not leave a message. I am not the captain, and you ignore Peach's call, and she emails you, all caps, "Where are you?" You write back, "Kurt, Swift. Writing emergency, long story, I am off to my writing retreat, haha, at Silver Seahorse in Bridgeport. You be good to you and lock the doors. Love, 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 Beck." And now Peach is mad at you, and honestly, I don't blame her. It is a bitch to drive to Bridgeport. You rent a car because, as we all know, the captain is paying. I am stuck in Mr. Mooney's enormous old Buick. I do a lot for you, Beck. You'd think I'd be the captain by now, and I don't listen to any music for the entire drive to Bridgeport. I'm too sad for music. Too sad for Elton John, and my head aches. Oh, captain, my captain. I cry. I get to Bridgeport first. The Silver Seahorse is a small motel near the water, one of those joints where all the rooms are off exposed walkways. Peach wouldn't even step foot in a place like this, but this must be the place because it's the only Silver Seahorse in Bridgeport. I listen to local news and eat a gas station burrito. I am so scared for you, for me, for us, that I can't finish the burrito. The captain, who is... this captain. You pull into the lot, and I slink down in the seat and watch you in the rearview mirror. You pop the trunk and walk around back, but you don't get out the bags because the captain moseys out of a motel room. He's at least 45, maybe 50, with Clooney gray hair. Is that what you're into? And he flicks his cigarette out. Fuck you, captain. I hope you die of cancer. And he picks you up and spins you around. And you know what, Beck? Now I am mad. Captain AARP, asshole, gets into your car. I follow the two of you as he drives, the fucker, and you've never been in a car with me, and you two pull up to an ATM at Cumberland Farms. You jump out of the car and come back with a wad of 20s. He makes you count the money. I hope he dies now. And you are angry and you count slowly, like a third grader practicing, and I am reminded of your Craigslist casual encounters, and I fear the worst. I follow you and the captain back to the Silver Seahorse, and this is me, Beck. The captain gets out first and opens the door for you, and you walk around back and get your bag out of the trunk, and he already has a key, and I am close enough to hear. Hey, can I have a smoke? He shakes his head. Honey, I can't do that. So it's fine for you, but not me? Do you bring a costume? Costume? Jesus. Do you think I brought a costume? You groan. Just one smoke, please. Hell if I'm gonna give one to you. Are you kidding me right now? This is when you decide to be a fucking father? You said father, and I might collapse as my brain waves sizzle and my heart stops. Father, you told me he was dead. You told everyone he was dead. Oh, Beck, why? I don't even know if I'm mad or sad, because in the present moment, I'm just so relieved that you're not paying or being paid to put on a schoolgirl outfit and get banged in a motel room. I breathe. The captain is your father. And your father has the key, and you groan and follow him into room 213. I want to know him. And I want to follow you in there, and I want him to shake my hand and tell me how happy he is to see that his daughter has got such a good man in her life. But you told me he is dead. So maybe you'd be happier if I went in there and made that happen? I'm confused, and it is colder by the second. It's off-season in the shithole that is Bridgeport, and the activity of checking into the room helps me steady myself. It's a lot to take in, but I'm relieved. I spout off some bullshit about lucky numbers and request the room adjacent to yours. They give it to me, and it smells like bleach and Newports, and the walls are thin, and after I shower, I throw one of the extra towels on the floor and sit down and listen to you fight with your dad. Something about money, kids. You sound like adults in Peanuts cartoons. He slams the door and you're alone. After you finish crying, you shower, and now you're wet and clean like I am. And I hear the door lock. You tear the blanket off the bed. It hits the floor. It's heavy. I hear it. And you start to work away at yourself and you moan. You're loud. I hear it. And now I'm working and you're working, and in my mind, there is no wall because I'm fucking you on that bed and you're bent over begging for it. And we're in Bridgeport because we want to fuck in a motel, and I'm pulling your hair and you're screaming. You are, Beck. You're loud. And there's no green pillow for you to cry into. And when it's all done, you turn on the TV and light a cigarette. I can hear it and I can smell it. And I'm so heavy from doing it with you and not doing it with you that it takes a minute before it hits me. You know the smiley face balloon was fine. And your father isn't a dead junkie. You're a fucking liar. Chapter 22. My, you have a way of making me do things I don't normally do. I haven't dressed up for Halloween since the third grade, Spider-Man. And though it's gotten harder over the years, I've managed to silently protest that whore of a holiday for the bulk of my life. Yet here I am in a mothball-scented dressing room at Bridgeport Costumes. The dressing room is so small that a fucking Smurf would be sweating. Celine Dion is singing about her fucking heart through the worst sound system in existence while the well-intentioned Irish shopkeeper prattles on a few feet from the dressing room. Have you got those pantaloons on yet, son? No, I say, and I look in the mirror and I want to die. But I can't die because you need me. Your father is dragging you to the Charles fucking Dickens Festival across the Sound in Port Jefferson. You don't want to go, but he rented you a costume, and after the two of you finished arguing this morning, you agreed to go spend time with his family. While you and your dad were getting ready for the festival, I hunkered down in my motel room and read up on this fucking festival. When you stepped out for a cigarette, I looked out at you, and I knew I had no choice. You were a vision in your costume. Drowning in red velour as your hair poured out from under a little red bonnet. You were smoking and pouting in the parking lot of the Silver Seahorse Motel. You were the only girl in the world who could look so serious and so silly at the same time. Your dad stepped outside to join you in a top hat and tails. He gives you a white fairy muff. What am I supposed to do with this? You asked. Put your hands in. Keep warm. But I have gloves. Beck, can you just give me a break here? You sighed and put your hands in that lucky muff, and I want to put my hands in you. I'm taking too long to get dressed, and the Irish shopkeeper taps her knuckles on the door. She wants a sneak peek, of course.
It's so nice to see young people like you getting into the spirit, she calls. If you don't mind my saying so, I think those pantaloons are going to suit you quite well, you know.
Yep, in a second.
And I'm not sure if I mentioned, she says for the third time. Rentals must be returned within 1 week of rental date. Otherwise, you might have an old Irish slag knocking at your door in the wee hours. Are you ready?
In a second, I say, and maybe Irish women don't speak English. Celine Dion is still screaming about her goddamned heart, and I'm choking on mothballs and self-loathing. And if you would have told your dad about me, he could have rented costumes for both of us. Then you'd be in here with me, and I wouldn't even notice the mothballs or the schmaltzy Canadian crap. But you lied to me. And now I have to walk out of the dressing room and tell the Irish lady that I'm attending the festival on my own.
Handsome chap like you won't go very long without finding a nice lass, I'm sure, she chortles.
And there's a mirror behind her, and fuck. This costume certainly does look good on me. My top hat is taller than your father's top hat, but this costume is not a disguise. Do you have any beards? She objects, jokingly.
Are you quite serious, young man?
It's cold out there.
We have beards, but they're not at all Dickensian.
I don't care, I say, and she grips my 20s and fumes. Small towns are scarier to me than cities. This woman, who seemed all kindly and obsequious a minute ago, is melting down because I want a beard. I'm kind of in a rush, I say, the slightest bit of an Irish affect. She lowers the volume on the ancient tape player. Celine Dion on cassette isn't very Dickensian either, but she concedes and points me toward the non-Dickensian, non-refundable beards which are in a box in the back marked Johnny Depp / Duck Dynasty. Fucking America, Beck. I just don't know sometimes. Life is aggravating when you're alone in a costume on a party boat with people who are all together in costumes on a party boat. We're not even close to docking at Port Jeff yet, and I shouldn't have boarded the ferry. I didn't think it through. What if you recognize me? You're not going to want to introduce me to your father while I'm in panta-fucking-loons. I should have gone back to New York, but there's no turning this festive boat around, so I'm trying to focus on the good. You haven't tweeted once since you've been here or sent one email. But bad thoughts creep in. Your father is back in the picture. What if this means that you tell your mother to shut off your phone? Calm down, Joe. I know your passwords, and I will always find a way into you. But I like having your phone. I like thinking of your mother paying for me to protect you. It's hard to be rational in a costume when I try again to think good thoughts. You are capable of going offline. And you're lying to everyone, not just me. And in a way, I'm having an easier go of it than you. You and your old man sit on bucket seats in the main cabin. You look gorgeous, of course. The rose on our Titanic vessel to my crafty, upbeat Jack. And if we were in this together, oh, Beck, I'd find my way under that skirt of yours. But neither you nor your father appears very excited for the festival, and I gather that he drives this boat. Deckhands give him shit for being in costume, and the captain of this particular trip steps out of the wheelhouse and insists on getting a picture of you and your old man. You don't want a picture, but your old man insists, and I'm tempted to storm across the deck and start a mutiny. But I have to let you and your dad work this out on your own. I know when you need your space. That's why I got the beard. Your dad asks if you want a drink, and you shrug. You want to make this as hard as can be? I just said I don't know. You sulk and you turn into a teenage girl around your father, which makes a lot of sense. Well, Guinevere, do you or do you not want something to drink? Coffee, you snap. Fine. He called you Guinevere. And a group of semi-drunk Chuck Dickens fans are starting to sing Christmas carols, and some fat guy in a Ben Franklin getup, oh, America, is trying to pass by and loses half of his beer on me. And the air is thick with mothballs and salt water and Coors, and I do not like it here one bit. Because you ran away to see your dad who is alive, alive, and because I want to be there in case you need me, I'm going to have to sell a fucking Dickens on eBay to cover the expenses of the motel, the costume, and the psychotherapy I'll no doubt need when I realize I am permanently fucked up from that day I froze my ass off in pantaloons and stood on a deck with a bunch of quarterwits. The halfwits are at home watching Great Expectations, the movie. The only thing worse than the boat trip to the festival is the festival itself. The public rape of Charles Dickens is an atrocity, Beck. Who knew such crap existed? You knew. You stay away from your half-brother and your half-sister, both of them kids, little ones, 6 and 8, I'd guess, in costume, everyone in costume, and Charles Dickens would be disgusted that his entire life's work is celebrated by rich old retirees who have nothing better to do than blow money on rented knickers and petticoats and wigs and cross Long Island Sound only to gather with other like-minded nitwits and stroll about the village of Port Jeff where they compliment one another on their fucking costumes and gorge on candied apples and act like it's fun to tour old homes and listen to 18th century guitar and gorge again on caramel popcorn and get their faces painted as if painted faces have anything to do with Dickens and listen to chamber music. Honestly, Beck, of all these white motherfuckers on this boat right now, seriously, no black person would ever do this. How many do you think could pass a test on Oliver Twist? How many do you think read his lesser-known works? But there was no way for me to not follow you into this town. And it's a good thing I'm always here, the Kevin Costner to your Whitney Houston, because people get weird in costumes, even old white dullards from Connecticut. They're slightly soused on beers. Day drinking is allowed when you're celebrating Dickens. And more than a couple of dudes have gotten a little too cheerful with you, and I've got a list in my head of everyone who needs a beatdown. I'd never hit a woman, but your stepmother doesn't like you, and she's jealous of the attention you get, and her kids aren't all that, and our kids will be cuter, and how does my anger with you always soften into love? Guinevere, your stepmother says. Your dad calls her Ronnie, and she's fighting 40 with Botox and bronzing powder and Spanx. You'll embrace your age, and you'll be beautiful, unlike Ronnie, who barks, "Did you give me change from that vendor with the candy apples?" "You gave me a 20. Your father looks like he's gonna explode, and he turns his attention to the shitty little kids, as if they need him right now, which they don't. You pout. "The candy apples were like $5 a pop." Now your dad gives a fuck, and he chastises you. "Guinevere, honey, come on." "Fine," you say, so brittle you might break. You pull both your hands out of your muff, and the muff hits the pavement, and you start fishing around in that giant Prada bag, and your stepmother picks up one of her unimpressive children and lodges the kid on her hip. "Prada," she says. "Did you get that on eBay?" "It was a gift," you say, and sometimes you do tell the truth. You hand her $2, and she takes it, and you look up at your dad. "Can we go?" The Dramamine I bought in the gift shop isn't working, and the ride back is worse than the ride out. I've spent the bulk of it in this tin can of a bathroom, and the colonial kinetic cunts are all banging down the door because they're all sick from too much food and fun. And this beard itches, and this boat rocks, and this toilet won't flush. I jiggle the handle. Some asshole fists the door. "Some of us got colons too, buddy." I don't dignify him with a response, but the goddamned boat breaches. Is the captain drunk too? And I get slammed against the wall, and when I throw up, I try to move my non-refundable beard, and it drops into the mess in the toilet. Plop. There's no way out of this one. And the faucet gives barely more than a trickle. If I don't get out of here soon, I'm only going to draw more attention to myself. There's nothing for me to do but bow my head and pray like hell that you aren't part of the lynch mob forming outside of the door to the latrine. If there is a god, you were holding it until you were back in the safe confines of the Silver Seahorse. And there is a god. There are only 4 people waiting, and it sounded like a dozen, and I make a run for the stern. The wind bites back there, and hopefully I will be alone, and hopefully I can ride out the rest of this trip without ruining your day. I think you would be scared if you saw me, and I think it would sound like bullshit if I told you that I went to meet family and there are tears streaked across my cheeks and I can't tell if I'm crying or if it's the wind. I miss my warm, scratchy beard, and the pantaloons are made of paper and my legs are fucking freezing. Finally, the boat slows as we ease into the harbor, and then something unimaginably horrible happens to me. Something so bad that I might jump off the boat. If it was summer, I would already be in the water because your little half-brother and half-sister are playing hide-and-seek. Great game to let your kids play on a boat, Ronnie. And I hear Ronnie calling for the little tykes who are hiding behind a box right in front of me. Breathe, Joe. Breathe. I hear Ronnie running, and she gets here fast and grabs each kid by the hand and looks at me. What a day, right? She's flirting with me because she's jealous of you. And I'm on Team Beck, and I know how to get back at her. Yes, ma'am. She didn't like that. And my ma'am had a twofold purpose. It was supposed to make her feel old, done, and it was also supposed to make her go away. But then 2 deckhands come out of nowhere, and the boat is turning ever so slightly, and the deckhands are unraveling rope, and the tired, drunk kinetic cunts are coming this way because it's just my fucking luck that this boat docks and offloads from the stern. And if there is a god, then you were fighting with your father and you were lost in conversation. If there is a god, I will be the first one off this boat. If there is a god, this slow-moving steel beast will get there already so your stepmother can take her kids home and feed them the mac and cheese they're screaming about. And if there is a god, then we are docking right now. We are. and there is a kid on land hoisting a ramp. There is. We are getting there, and I will be third, maybe fourth off this boat, and people are starting to get pushy. And if there is a God, that is not you I hear behind me. And if there is a God, Ronnie will not ask me, to move out of the way. My husband is trying to get through, she says, and she knows how to exact her revenge as well. Your father squeezes by me and apologizes for the close quarters. He turns his head and whistles for you, just as the boat finally settles and the deckhand releases the ramp that connects the boat to the land. Coming, you say. Jesus Christ, people, this isn't Ellis fucking Island. And I love your sense of humor and disgust. And I love you, and that's why, like a flower to the sun, I turn my head a millimeter, just enough to see your beautiful face and long enough for you to see mine. Before the deckhand slaps the ramp down and locks it into place, and I shove my way through that crowd and get off that fucking boat. Chapter 23. Every time I approach an exit, I want to pull off and find a gas station and change out of this musty costume. But I don't. I am paralyzed behind the wheel. I am so panicked that I can only go forward. And the reason is horrifyingly simple. You have called me 4 times in the last hour since the ferry docked, and this can only mean one thing. You saw me. No! I shout, and I feel like I've been driving forever, and I punch the steering wheel, and the Buick veers into the right lane, and I cut off a truck, and the trucker blows his horn, and I open my window, and I roar, "Go fuck your mother!" If he responds, I don't hear it, and I roll the window up by hand. Mr. Mooney's a cheap old bastard, and I gotta slow down, because it would suck to get pulled over right now. And it's not like this is my fault, you know? You lied to me. Your father is not dead. I was on that boat because you lied to me. Maybe I don't know you as well as I think I do, but that's ridiculous. We have a connection. It's just that you messed up. You were supposed to tell me about your dad, no matter how ashamed you were. And I was supposed to listen and love you and tell you that you were good. And then you would ask me about my life, and I would tell you, and you would listen to me the way I listened to you, and then we would have been closer. I ride up on a girl going too slow, and she flips me off hard. She has a bumper sticker, "Tailgaters flunked physics," and a Boston College sticker, and I hate driving, and I would like to ram this car into her Volvo and watch her bleed out, but no, Joe, no, she's not the bad guy, and she won't pay for your mistakes. This is on you, Beck. You messed up big time, and you know I followed you, and you know! I lay on my horn and tailgate that bitch until she puts on her blinker. When I pass her, I slow down so I ride right next to her with one hand on the wheel and one hand giving her the bird. The bitch laughs and I move on. Fuck her. Fuck you! You will never forgive me, and I need to never see you again, and I need this family in the Land Rover to fuck off with their skis and their brand new tires, and I ride up on them too, hard, and my phone rings. You. The kid in the backseat disobeys his father and turns around, and you know what I know about that kid? That kid will end up at Choate Rosemary Hall, alumni sticker in the rear window, and that kid will be smoking dope and popping pills before his 13th birthday, and everyone will think it's so fucking glamorous because he's popping pills in the woods off in Connecticut. I give him the finger. I give him a memory. I know what that kid will become, and I know he won't pay for his bad choices. He'll get sympathy and respect, and I veer around them and jump in front and slam on my brakes, and the father beeps, pissed now, alive now, and I rev up and I'm out of there. Fuck them and their skis and their snow boots. The heat in this car is broken, and I'll never get over the cold from the ferry. I'll never be able to look at Dickens without going back to this day, and I pull over to a rest stop and I shut off the engine. It's so fucking quiet. It's so December. And it's so over. My phone rings again, loud. You. I ignore. Again. And I delete the message because I can't bear the idea of you screaming in fear at me and accusing me of being a stalker. No. This is all wrong, and I punch the wheel again, and my knuckles are bruised, and the bruises will heal, but you will never forget the time that guy followed you to Connecticut and put on a costume, and stalked you at a festival. I am probably already an anecdote in the hopper in your head. Fodder for a story, a thing of the past, just another suitor. I cry. You call. I shut off my phone. I shut off your phone before your mommy shuts it off, which she probably will eventually. It is a dark day. Literally. I drop off Mr. Mooney's keys, and he's got his oxygen tank and his Bowie knife, and someday I'll have an oxygen tank and a Bowie knife because you're never speaking to me again, and I know it. He means so well, and he's such a stand-up guy, a veteran in overalls, and here I am, and I can't look him in the eye right now because it's so hard to admit that much as I admire him, respect him, well, I don't want to be like him. I'm a terrible person, and he's a good man. He's holding the door open, and old people are painfully lonely when they're alone. It breaks my heart how obviously, badly he wants me to come in and have a Pabst with him. A good guy would go in. But we all know I'm a fucking tool. He tries to joke around. What's with the outfit, Joseph? I forgot about my costume, and I think, I went to a costume party? He doesn't want to know about the party. Shop's good? Yeah, real good, Mr. Mooney, real good. I offer him the keys, but he shakes me off. He's still holding the door open. He's not the kind of man who would ever verbalize the fact that he wants company, but he gets it. The way I tuck the keys into my pocket and step back, he retreats into his dank, molding home. You hang on to those keys, he tells me. I never use the car anyway. You sure, Mr. Mooney? Where am I going? Well, I can take you there if you need. He waves me off, and he won't need to go anywhere. There's a dude from church who takes him to the doctor. And at this point in his life, there's nowhere else to go. I should go inside. But I just can't right now. He turns around. I'll bump into you, kid. Thanks, Mr. Mooney. The door shuts quietly, and I walk, aimlessly. But somehow I reach my place. One of my typewriters is laughing at me, I swear, because of my costume. I pick it up and I throw it at the wall. Fuck it. It's not like the landlord's ever fixing anything anyway. I strip out of my costume and I want to burn it, but I put it in a shoebox and tape it up. I don't want to look at it anymore. And I write the address, and when I have to put Bridgeport, I lose my grip on the pen. I throw on my worst comfort clothes, a raggedy Nirvana t-shirt that my mother left behind, and nasty fleece pants from a rummage sale on Houston 100 years ago. I want to look as miserable as I feel, and I tear into the Twizzlers I bought at the Korean deli by Mr. Mooney's place. The new hole in my wall says it all. There are 2 Twizzlers left, and I've lost time like I sometimes do in here, and I am listening to Eric Carmen's Make Me Lose Control on repeat, self-destructing, cutting myself with sappy lyrics about a time in history that I'm too old to remember, about summer love and convertibles with huge back seats. There's a knock at the door, and there is never a knock at the door, or a hole in the wall, and there is another knock. I stop the music. There is another knock. Chapter 24. When I open the door, I die. You are here. In my building. In powder blue corduroys and a little furry jacket. You want to come inside, and this is dangerous. All the pieces of you that I've collected are here with me, and you are not meant to see them. You still smell like you, like heaven. And you look like you've been crying. You move toward me, and I clench the doorknob. Beck. You sigh. I get it, okay? You don't hear from me for a while, and then I call you 50 times and show up at your doorstep like some fucking crazy stalker. And now I know. It's safe to let go of the doorknob. You didn't see me on the ferry. You are soft in your eyes and safe. You want to come in. I play with you. You're not some crazy stalker? Well, a little crazy, you say. I had to force the kid at your shop to give me your address. You were too small to force anyone to do anything, and I will kill him. And you are frazzled, and there's nothing for me to do but get out of the way and let you in. You hesitate once you're inside, as if you've walked into the worst of the bathroom stalls at a movie theater, and I wish I had cleaned. There's an open can of sardines in the sink. That wouldn't be there if I'd known you were coming. But if I draw attention to the fucking fish, well, that's not good either. I like your shirt, you say. Nirvana. Thanks, I blurt. It was my mom's. You nod, because what the fuck are you supposed to say to that? Do you want me to open a window? I stammer. No, you say. I'll get used to it. Fucking Curtis. And I scan the living room for bras or panties or emails. Nothing. Miracle. You were slipping out of your furry jacket and unzipping your boots and settling onto my sofa like you own the place. One good thing, you are so all about you that you don't seem to notice my apartment. You were blowing your nose and squirming, and I sit in my chair that I found in the alley by the bookshop a few weeks ago. When I dragged that chair home on the subway, I assumed nobody would ever see it again, that it was like the chair's last day of being seen. So, I know it's been a while, you say. But I needed someone, and I thought of you, and you didn't answer my calls. I'm sorry, I say. And I should have given you a chance. If I were a brave man, this conversation would be happening in your apartment. You hug your knees and rock. Anyway, I just don't even know right now. I'm a mess. Are you okay? You shake your head no. Did someone hurt you? Your eyes well up and you look at me like you've been protecting someone for so long. Like you've always said no and the answer is yes and you squeak out an answer. Yes. And you're bawling. I go to you and let you cry and you don't say anything for a while. I scoop you into my arms and let you cry. Your tears soak my t-shirt and I feel like some stalker who will never wash his clothes again. And your whole body is shaking from unhappiness. And I will make you rattle with joy soon, soon. You pat me on the back. Okay, I'm okay. I understand that you need your space, and I return to my chair, and you let out a big sigh. Have you ever carried a secret around? I mean a secret as in a lie? And one day you just fucking can't do it anymore? And you have to let it out? I see Candace's musical fucking brother on TV sometimes, and I want to smash the screen and tell him that his sister did not drown while body surfing. I nod. Yeah, I get it. Your eyes skate around, and they finally land on me. Well, it's a long story, but Joe, here's the thing. I lied to you. And to everyone. My dad is not dead. He's very alive and very well and living on Long Island. Whoa, I say. You chose me. I couldn't hold it in anymore, you say. I had to tell someone or else. I get it, I say, and I do. And I think that you didn't choose someone, you chose me. And that means something, Beck. You hunted me down, me. And you know how girls are, you say. If I told Peach or Hannah or Lynn or anyone like that, then they'd tell someone and that person would tell someone and someone would send out some cryptic tweet about it and, that's why I thought of you. I knew you'd let it stay here. I get it, I say, and I do. I keep many secrets and now I have yours. And honestly, you know, in a way, I'm not lying because in every way he is dead to me, Joe, you rail on. But the thing is, he married a lawyer and she's rich and he has money and I'm broke. And of course, he won't just give me money. No, I have to troll around in a fucking Charles Dickens dress with his spoiled offspring in order to get anything out of him. That was a lot of information, I say. Charles Dickens? You laugh and tell me about the festival. I have to be careful here, and I act like I've never heard of such a thing, and I let you share the details, and I'm methodical in my reactions, and then I shake my head. This is a lot, I say. Is it worth it? Putting up with all that for a few bucks? Well, life costs money, you say, and you cross your arms. If he can pay for his new kids to eat organic candy apples, then he should have to pay for his old kid, too. I get it, I say, and I do. Your dad and his wife probably blew 400 bucks on Dickens costumes, hot cocoa, and candy apples. And you're not the kind of girl to wait tables. Your friends don't worry about money, why should you? You finish sending a text and relax your arms and lower your legs, and when animals open up like that, they want to fuck. You're my animal on my sofa, and you look around my home. Wow, you say. You really do like old things. I found every single thing in here on the street, I say, proud. I see that, you say, disgusted. You prefer new, sterile IKEA, yet you tuck your dirty tissues into your mangy purse. Ah, women. You wiggle your toes and start in about your dad again. Divorce is different, and you're from a poorish family, you know? My dad met Ronnie on the island when she was on vacation. Literally, Joe, he met her at a bar where my sister was working, and it was hard enough to start college as the girl who grew up where everyone else goes to vacation. I didn't want to tell people that my towny dad ran off with a tourist. Enough already, you know? It's not fair, I say. It's not, you say, and I've never seen you so worked up. Being an Ivy League townie is one thing, but a townie with an absentee father? Fuck that, it's a cliche. I get it, I say, and I do. I love you for being the prideful, scrappy little fighter that you are. You're powerful, you kill people, you're brutal. I figured when I moved here I'd start all over, but I didn't think it through, you sigh and shake your head. Everyone from school is here, and if I told my friends about my dad now, I'd have to deal with it, you know? I know. I say. People can be judgmental about stuff like this. You have to watch out. Nobody knows, you say, and your eyes are big. Mine. Nobody. Except me, I say, and you blush. Except you. You repeat, and you smile. Almost. And then you sadden. And I know I shouldn't be so insecure, but he didn't just leave, you know? He built a whole new family with a younger, cuter wife and younger, cuter kids. Those kids are not cuter than you, Beck. You're not in a suspicious mindset, thank God, and you laugh, assuming that I'm making an assumption. All kids are cuter than adults, Joe, you sigh. That's just the evil nature of Mother Nature. Well, fuck her, I say, and I get a laugh out of you. You did your part. You saw him and his family. Did he help you out with some dough? You stretch your arms up toward the ceiling and stretch to the right and notice the hole in the wall right behind you. Jesus, you say, that's a big fucking hole. I swallow. A pipe burst upstairs and they had to get in there. And apparently they did, you say, and now you're tuning into your environment. You notice Larry, my broken typewriter on the coffee table. You look at me for permission to touch him. I nod. You tell lies. I hoard typewriters. We are different. Hot. His name is Larry, I say. I'm gonna be honest, like you. Do you name all your typewriters, you ask? No, I say. I don't name them. They tell me their names when I bring them home. It is fun to fuck with you, and you can't decide if I'm pretentious or insane, and I can't tell if you're being sweet or patronizing when you laugh. Right. Beck, I say. Of course I name them. I'm just kidding. Well, Larry is handsome, you say, and you lean forward to say hello to him and tinker with his keys. I can see your panties. You ask me a question. Can I hold him? He's heavy, Beck. You can put him on my lap, you say, and you're wearing pink seamless bikinis, size small, from the Victoria's Secret Angels collection. I pick up Larry and set him on your lap and pray that you don't notice that your panties are identical to the panties shoved in between the cushions of the sofa. I tell you that Larry is broken because he fell, ha ha ha, and you pet him, sweet. Well, Larry may be broken, but he's a handsome beast, Joe. He's a one of a kind, I say. You study Larry. He's missing an L. I have to lie because I can't have you looking around for the L. Since the day I brought him home, you look at me. Do you have anything to drink? I don't have anything to drink. Fucking Curtis. You return your attention to the typewriter and you want to look between the cushions and make sure the L isn't lost, but if you do that, you will find your panties, which you will know are yours if you have a keen sense of smell, which I think you do. You're like a toddler that needs distraction, and I take a Twizzler and you grab the last two. Do you have any more of these? You say. Afraid not, I say. And now I'm worried because you stop chewing and your eyes lock on something in my bedroom. You squint. Is that the Italian Dan Brown I gave you? I want to close my door, but that would be weird, so I turn around and follow your gaze and realize you are looking at the special shelf I built for the Italian Dan Brown. It could be worse. I could have put the Book of Beck on that shelf. I think that's your book, I lie. You pet Larry and you grin. That's sweet, Joe. I swallow the rest of my Twizzler, and I have to get you out of here. You want to go get some more Twizzlers? Hell yes. You say, and I walk over to you, and you look even smaller with Larry on your lap, and you pat him. Lift, please. I lift him off your lap, and your powder blue cords have new dark scuff marks. And I put him in his normal spot on the floor, and you step back into your boots and slip into your little furry jacket, and walk across the room away from the evidence of my affection, your panties and your bras. What a relief to open the door and lead you out of my home. And it's a whole new world with you in it. You pause in the stairwell and point to a smudge on the wall.
Blood? You whisper, alive and jocular. My furry nymph.
And I nod in affirmation, and you raise your eyebrows.
Larry's blood?
I smack your ass, and you like it. And you hop down my stairs, and I'm the only one who knows about your dad, and soon it will be time for the red ladle. You push open the doors that I've been pushing open for almost 15 years. We walk to the bodega, and you're practically skipping.
Is this the part they're trying to make into a historical district, you ask? I read about that somewhere.
No, I say. This is the other part of Bed-Stuy. My section reminds you of Sesame Street and Jennifer Lopez songs. And every guy in the shop wants to bang you, but you're with me. You like the attention. You tell me you feel like a celebrity in here, and you giggle. I pay for the Twizzlers and the Avion, and you shove the Twizzlers in your back pocket, as if you need to draw more attention to your ass. So this is what it would be like if you lived here with me. It would be good, warm. Before you know it, we are back on my stoop. We sit close and tear into the Twizzlers and share the Avion. A couple of teenage girls from the block pass by and mad dog you with your Avion, and you get sweet, defensive, and assure me that you only drink Avion because Peach says it's alkaline, and you're not wearing a bra, the way you weren't wearing a bra the first day in the shop, and it really does feel like a new beginning. You scruff my hair with your cold little hand.
You want to go back up?
Yeah, I say, and I wish I could have prepared for you, hidden your things and showered and put on matching socks. But you are here now, walking up my stairs, slowly, teasing me with every deliberate soft step. It's a blur from then on. My shitty sofa transforms into a hammock on a desert island in a Corona commercial minus the beer. We don't need beer. We don't need anything. We have us now. I keep my arms around you, and you hold me in a way that would please Eric Carmen. We suck face until we can't, and then we just tell each other things. You tell me all about the Dickens Festival, the fight with your father over cigarettes, your step monster and the shitty motel, the bratty step-siblings, the overpriced candy apples. You want to know about me, and I tell you I like you. A lot. We go back to sucking face. It goes on like that for a while, and you're all worn out and cozy. When you finally fall asleep, your little body is limp. I don't know if I will ever be able to sleep with you this close to me. You can't tell lies in your sleep, and you smile slightly, I think, every so often, and move closer to me. The only reason I know that I am able to sleep in such close proximity to you is that the next morning the sound of the shower turning on wakes me up, and you are no longer in my arms, and you are naked, wet. There. Chapter 25. If you live alone, you'd be a fucking masochistic freak to buy an opaque shower curtain. I started thinking about this in the Silver Seahorse, where the shower curtain was white, save a few spots of mold on the bottom. It's like they were trying to make the rooms feel like Psycho. I thought buying a shower curtain would be the easiest fucking thing in the world, but you go to Bed Bath & Beyond and they have like 600 opaque shower curtains that are obviously not an option. And then you go online and there are thousands to choose from. I didn't buy a totally clear one because you need something to look at while you're on the can. But when you think about it, this shower curtain is something you are going to look at every fucking day. So I started going through hundreds of options online. Most of the designs are bullshit you could never stomach every day. A map of the world. Go fuck yourself. Fish. A map of Brooklyn. Really go fuck yourself. Snowmen. The Eiffel Tower. Nautical signs. I mean, I'm not some fucker who buys scarves at Urban Outfitters and rates movies on IMDb. I just wanted something funny and classic. I finally settled on the clear shower curtain with yellow police tape marked Police Line Do Not Cross slapped across. And when I bought this shower curtain, I never imagined that you would be on the other side of the police tape, those damn yellow stripes blocking my view of you. Next time, I'm going for an all-clear, Beck. Lesson learned. And really, it's all for the best, because I don't have time to watch you shower. I have to take this opportunity to hide all the Beck-mobilia and hope that you didn't do any snooping when you woke up. I retrace your steps. You left the bathroom closet door open, typical woman, after you got a towel. Fortunately, you took the towel on top and you didn't find your bras stashed under the bottom towel. Hopefully, you didn't open the medicine cabinet in the bathroom and find your scratched up silver hair clip
I stole it the first day I stepped into your apartment. Those clips are everywhere. You'd never miss it, right? I needed it because a few delicious strands of your hair are woven in, holding your DNA, your scent. Did you open the refrigerator door and find your leftover bottle of Nantucket Nectar Diet iced tea, half empty? Your lips touched it, and I wanted to keep your lips in my refrigerator. You did pour a glass of water, and there is always the possibility that you would have mistaken your iced tea bottle for my own. The bathroom door is the one thing in here that is actually not even slightly broken, and you could have closed it all the way, but you didn't. It's like you want all doors open at all times, the way your windows have no curtains in your apartment. And I can't help but feel excited that in some way you wanted me to sneak a peek at you in there. Right now, blocked by that big bird-colored police tape. You arch your back and let the water hit one tit, and then another tit, and then you turn around and you like it here, in my shower, in my home. And you let the water go at your neck and drip down your back, and you take the bar of ivory soap, my soap, and hold it between your breasts, and move it down and let it fall. And then you rub the suds on your belly, lower, lower, until your hands are down there. And then as soon as they're down there, they're back up on your neck, and you're holding back, and you're so hot for me right now, and I should take off my clothes and get in the shower, but if I did that, you would look at the moving door and realize that your white bikini top is hanging on the doorknob. I know you didn't notice it yet, and there's a chance you will never notice it since you didn't close the door all the way. I can grab the bikini and pray that you're so wrapped up in your sopping wet double entendre baby self and don't notice, or I can leave it there and assume that when you do finish cleaning, not fucking, that you will be so preoccupied with drying off and blinded by the steam that you won't notice your own bikini top. Who am I kidding? I have to get that bikini top. I close my eyes. I pray. My hand is shaking when I reach around to the interior side of the door and pull it off the doorknob. You don't notice, and everything is safe again, and I really need you to get the fuck out of my apartment. I put your bikini behind the frozen Stouffer's things I buy but never eat, and then you are out of the shower, out of the bathroom, and you call out, "Hey Joe, where you going with that gun in your hand?" For a second I panic. You know, and the bikini is a gun, and I am fucked. You are in a towel, dripping, and I look like a fucking lunatic against the fridge. "I'm just kidding," you say. "I know it's a bad joke, but it's not that bad. Chill out." "I guess you found the towels?" "I hope it's okay," you murmur. And my home is no place for bare feet, and you keep moving around because the floors are sticky and dirty. And you're looking down at my typewriters and asking too many questions, and you're picking up my taxidermy miniature alligator head that I would have hidden if I knew you were coming, and this is wrong. All wrong. This is not right in the morning light, and you got to sleep here and shower and soap up without making love to me, and in what universe can that possibly be a good thing? Your clean hands are too clinical right now, and you're examining this place like it's a crime scene. Maybe that yellow tape put you on guard. You were asking when I started collecting typewriters and dead animals and jokingly asking if I'm a serial killer and pointing at the hole in the wall and saying, "Joseph, tell me again about the hole." And yeah, you're laughing, and you don't mean for me to defend at all, but this is not good for us, and you're too clean, and I have sleep in my eyes and morning wood and no coffee and no eggs to make for you. The faucet drips. You didn't shut it off all the way. But I can't shut it off because you can't be alone in my living room. You excuse yourself to the bathroom, and you wash your hands with a lot of soap, taxidermy, and typewriters. When you get out of my bathroom with your freshly scrubbed hands, you're all done with me. Talking about school, kissing me goodbye, no tongue. When you leave, I sit in the wet tub and breathe you in. All of you. "Dude, don't you think that's a little harsh?" Curtis is pleading his case and turning red, and the little shit has never been fired before, and suddenly he loves it here at Mooney's, and suddenly he gives a shit, and suddenly my pothead minion is never getting stoned again. "Curtis, the right thing to do now is just say, 'Okay, boss.'" He flares, and a fat little woman knocks on the counter like it's a door.
"Excuse me, guys, but do you have any zone cookbooks?"
"Yeah," I say, and I am about to say where, but suddenly Curtis actually works here and actually gives a shit, and he's zipping behind me and leading the sweet little fatty to the cookbooks and talking to her about our ability to special order any zone book her fat little heart could desire and telling her about our return policy. So loudly you'd think she was deaf, not fat, and it's amazing how people only shape up until they have a gun against their head, and then I hear you, "Hey Joe, Where are you going with that gun in your hand? And that morning was all his fault, and he will pay.
He must pay. And the fat lady wants to pay part by check, and part by cash, and part by credit card. And I have to wonder, how will she afford to buy the ingredients in the zone book recipes, and suddenly Curtis is a fucking volunteer policeman? All about double-checking her driver's license like I taught him to do. Like he never does, and running the credit card the right way, hard and tilted so that the week-old machine picks up the swipe. He's inserting a bookmark in each fucking cookbook, and man, this kid, only a nutjob psychopath perfectionist motherfucker would fire this kid. So good he is, so dedicated. The little fat lady is pleased, and she whistles at me.
Yoo-hoo, hon.
I nod and I smile, and she should have addressed me as sir.
You should give this young man a raise,
she says, and she's pink all over from hustling around the store.
I tell you, I was in another little shop uptown for 2 hours before someone came to help me, and this young man you have here was a wonderful and gracious host to me, and knowledgeable, too.
I'd like to tell her that in both bookstores and coffee shops, it's actually polite to leave browsers and readers alone. When you harass people and offer to help them too much, they feel like you're nudging them out the door. This lady doesn't know anything about the world, and she's still raving about this friendly young man, and I would like to tell her that overeager Curtis, did he start doing meth or something, has actually driven customers away today because most people don't want to be interrupted when they're reading the first few pages of a novel. Oh, I want her to know that Curtis smokes pot 4 times a day and steals bicycles and fences them for spare cash. I could tell her that he is late every fucking shift and that he shits in the bathroom on a regular basis. Rude. And that he's cheated on every girlfriend he's ever had. And that when she exits this place, were he not getting his ass fired, he'd mock her to high hell and possibly even write down her checking account information. Yes, she pays with a check. Instead, I just smile at the gal. You're the exact reason that we open up shop every day, I say. We're in the business of helping people buy books.
This is just like that Meg Ryan movie, she squeals. You know, where the nice girl has the small shop and she falls in love with the man with the big shops?
Curtis fucking sings.
You've got mail!
You've got mail, she cries and she laughs. Oh, I love that movie. Do you have that here? DVDs?
This sloth won't use her cookbooks. She will buy a small shelf at Target and have someone nail it into the wall in her kitchen. She will line up those cookbooks and love the way they look and throw a pizza in the microwave and tear into the DVD of You've Got Mail that she'll truck across town to buy. She'll never come back here again. When she goes, Curtis gets it somehow. He knows he's done.
Dude, he says, for what it's worth, I thought I was helping you out. That chick was hot, bangable hot.
You don't give out my address to strangers.
She said she knew you. Did I say bangable? Mad bangable.
Let it be known that I only punched him once, and not in the face. You better remember that, Beck. It's not like I'm some monster, and it's not like I hurt him. I fired him, man to man, boss to worker. It wasn't personal. And it wasn't hardcore, and that fat lady was the first customer he treated well since week fucking one. Also, you're not bangable, Beck. You're beautiful. There's a difference.
Chapter 26. The day after our sleepover without sex, you asked me to meet up with you in Midtown. Curtis was gone, and I was alone in the shop. But the day after a woman is naked in your apartment, everyone knows the only thing to say to her is yes. We picked up your new cable box. The line was a mile long. Then you sent me home. And it's been more of the same for the past 2 weeks. Today, you asked me to meet you in front of a Starbucks in Herald Square, where I stand now as you kiss me hello on the cheek. You're not going to sit on my lap in an overstuffed chair and lick whipped cream off my upper lip. You're in get-it-done daytime mode, and Christmas shoppers walking by probably think I'm your gay best friend. My dick hurts, Beck. Where's my holiday? So the good news is, I know exactly what I want. You do, I say, and I hope you'll ask me to eat you out in the bathroom at Starbucks.
I want to get my mom those headphones that double as earmuffs.
Ah, digital earmuffs are the physical opposite of oral sex.
And the better news is, I have a coupon, you say, and we are on our way into Macy's.
Now you start in about money. You're strapped for cash. I pretend that I didn't read the emails you exchanged with your father this morning. I know that you're waiting to see if your old man, the captain, is going to help you out. We are in the ladies' shoes section. Didn't you want earmuffs? When you ask me about Curtis, I tell you that I caught him stealing and fired him. I do not tell you it was because he gave you my address. You sigh. He seemed like a good kid.
Huh.
We wander through jewelry. Didn't you just need earmuffs? And you want to know when I'll hire a new clerk. I'll tell you that the only thing more impossible than finding good help is running the store on my own. You nod and agree that most people are unemployable. And is this really how it's going to be,